7-day intensive seminar, School of the Master, Lecture 3, Wednesday, August 15th. Lecture 3, Build a Bond with Divine Within, with the Divine Within. Tune into the Divine Path Within through introspection in the 3-hour meditation. Recognize that the Divine Indwelling is our playful self and take life lightly. Techniques, talk, think, walk, and be with the center of my being. Let go of the mystery of the inner presence. Be one as its awareness. Okay, so I have a few little things here I'd like to share with you. This came from an article here on Discovery Magazine, and it's called Jaron's World, and it has a paragraph here where science is poo-pooing religion, and science is poo-pooing stuff like that, and it's not too cool. So he says here, science can declare the approximate limits of its territorial ambitions and be stronger for it. My dearly missed old friend Stephen Jay Gould framed this possibility beautifully when his proposal for non-overlapping magisterium. I'll go further and suggest that scientists should not only refrain from ridiculing people who find hope on the other side of the border, but should also actively delight in the cataphorious multicultural colonization of that far frontier so that it can't be monopolized by fundamentalists. A workable definition of spirituality is one's emotional relationship with unanswerable questions. It is possible to find joy in them. Interesting comment. A workable definition of spirituality. One's emotional relationship with unanswerable questions. That's quite something. Then he had another article here, which was quite telling. And right here, there it is. It's about this young man who John Matsky was just 30 years old when he was told that he had only 18 months to live. At 6 feet 4 inches tall, with blue eyes, broad shoulders, Matsky cut an impressive figure. He'd been a football player at Dartmouth College, where he studied geology. That was also where he met his wife. He lived in Wisconsin in a small homestead where he grew organic vegetables and other good things. The doctor told him he had a short time to live. But Matsky didn't follow his doctor's recommendations. Instead, he took a month off from his work to strengthen his body for the treatment that he knew would almost likely be a grueling ordeal, chemotherapy and stuff like that. He went on long hikes in the mountains. He ate heartily foods. He ate healthy foods, probably heartily too. He ate healthy foods, and he meditated. He also took a lot of time picturing himself healthy and visualizing good, strong blood cells destroying the cancer in his body. He also took a lot of time picturing himself healthy and visualizing good, strong blood cells destroying the cancer in his body. Matsky later flew back to Vermont, where his doctor repeated the chest x-rays to document the size and location of the tumor before starting treatment. But instead of a large cancerous lesion in Matsky's lung, he saw nothing. O'Donnell recalls, when John came back a month later, it was mistakable. The tumor on his chest x-ray was gone. Gone, gone, gone. Call it remarkable, call it miraculous. Such spontaneous remissions are as fascinating to physicians and scientists as they are rare. Doctors would like to understand cases like Matsky's, who was given just 18 months to live, but would survive for another 18 years, and so forth. Interesting. These are things that people write about. Citizen, heal thyself. Interesting articles, interesting conditions, and interesting stories. But all this makes no difference to anybody when people do not follow the rules. And Matsky didn't follow the rules. He cleaned himself up. He mentally disposed of the object that was bothering him. He healed himself. He brought about the remission himself. But, as the article states, 18 years later, more cancer came in and ate him up. Because he had not strengthened himself with his attitude of mind about himself. He did not get rid of those negative influences which were causing him to want to destroy his body. Now, all medical things that want to destroy our body, all conditions that come about, are things that we have put into motion for some reason. For some reason, we want to destroy ourselves. For some reason, we don't feel that we are worthwhile. For some reason, we feel that we are insufficient as human beings or divine beings. And because of that, we want to destroy ourselves. Now, how can we change our attitude from that? Now, he was a nice, tall fellow, a nice, strong fellow. He had everything seeming to go in for him. But somewhere in his heart, in his world, in his life, even at the age, up to the age of 30, he had some tremendous anger that was making this cancer grow. Now you say, well, how can we know? How can we ever know? Well, you can. So I share with you the idea that if you say, I like me, I'm divine order and peace, whatever anxiety, whatever anger, whatever condition was bringing about this growth, this cancer, this problem in the body, has to go. Because you now like yourself. You no longer want to put a cause in motion to destroy yourself. You no longer want to kill yourself. And people do that. I told you about Irene down in El Centro and how she was dying of cancer, and I said she had a chance to change her mind if she wanted to, and be whole and perfect. And so she did. But Irene, like everybody else, didn't go that step further and like herself. She just got rid of the cancer. She just worked on the problem, and she solved the problem. She poofed it away, like a doctor would do with surgery and so forth. And she had her doctor tell her family there was a misdiagnosis, and the doctor did that, and poof, she was whole and perfect. A true story. But her grandson, who had been giving her a pain in the neck, he was a teenager, and he was being very miserable. He's not a bad kid, he's a normal kid, but not for a member of her family. She was from the aristocratic group down there, and her family were all quality type people and all good type people, and multimillionaires, you know, very wealthy people. And her grandson didn't act like that. And so, what happened? So what happened is that not more than 5 or 6 years later, the grandson continued with his nefarious activities and made her so distressed. She decided to go again. We know of another case like that. in New Jersey, where this woman had been such a beautiful lady, doing everything beautiful, helping everyone in a very wonderful way, and then it came time to retire. But in her retirement, she had nothing to take care of. None of her family needed her anymore because they were all grown and taking care of their own lives and doing just fine. But her grandson, who was not doing like he should have done, brilliant kid, he created in himself some very tough attitudes about life, and she took this upon herself as her own cross and decided to die. She didn't have to. She had nothing wrong with her. She was living in her ideal, perfect body. She was a nurse. She had been going around healing everybody else, taking care of other people, working with people until they were in their hundreds of years old, taking care of them, being beautiful. But because she had no desire to live because of what her grandson was doing, even though he was a very fine boy in other ways, and he's going to be a lawyer and everything else, but he made her so totally, totally bereft with life that she decided to go. Now, I worked with her on this, but she wouldn't admit to the fact that this was her problem, and she wouldn't admit to the fact that if she would change her mind about it, that she could live and have a happy life. She felt, all is lost, just that pathetic attitude. Because all of her life she gave herself to her family. All of her life she raised her family. All of her life she put them through school, through college. All of her life she did everything for everybody else. And then when this one grandson, and who I'm again repeating, was not a bad person, he just did not live up to her standard of being a mother, and she should have kept her nose out of this, but she couldn't do it. He caused her to feel so sorry for herself that she just did not want to live any longer. And I was with her virtually days before she died, and she just was playing her game, and it was kind of a shame. There's a lot of stories that I can tell you out of that, which are very meaningful to clean up your own act, but for the moment we'll just leave it that way. Now, you want to take care of yourself. You sometimes forget to do that. And you forget to do that because of silly things. We're going to do all that we can in working with the brain. We're going to do all that we can in working with the mind and in getting the mind and the brain all organized to do beautiful things. But we have a big problem. And that problem is that you, each one of you, would love to have somebody come along and put a chip in your brain and make you all of a sudden super intelligent. You'd love to have somebody come along and put a chip in your brain and take away your diseases or your illnesses or anything else like that. You'd like to have someone come along and put a chip in your brain to straighten out your mental attitude about yourself. Well, okay, here's this little article about that, which is kind of fascinating and kind of silly because it is limiting. It says, boosting our gray matter. Bright idea or not, brain enhancements may become as available and compulsory as software updates. There's a famous scene in the sci-fi movie The Matrix where the heroine Trinity learns to fly a helicopter by uploading instructions straight to her brain. Neuroscientists would love to master the trick so they could help patients suffering from brain injuries and diseases. In fact, in animal experiments, scientists are already tackling all aspects of brain repair and enhancement, using electronic implants and biological techniques to boost memory and other functions. A few labs have even gone human test subjects have even given human test subjects the ability to control a computer cursor with their thoughts and more. There's no telling how today's research will change the world of work in 10 or 20 years' time. But once the tools and techniques are perfected, there's little question competitive individuals will get swept into the race to expand their brain capacity. As that gets underway, it's destined to overturn today's paradigm of cubicled executives laboring on laptops, palm devices, and cell phones, besieged by constant software updates. Perhaps the electronically augmented executive of 2025 will be able to absorb whole new fields of information by beaming it matrix style straight to the circuits in their modified cortex. But even this scenario perhaps underestimates the workplace revolution that lies ahead. If we think Wi-Fi, BlackBerry's blogs, social networks, and Second Life are changing the way we work, wait until you see what enhanced cognitive equipment can do. Medical scientists today have spend little time dreaming about enhanced humans. They're too busy aiding the ill or injured, trying to reverse the ravages of Parkinson's disease, or struggling to help patients cope with anxiety or depression. But where demand exists, supply follows. Anything for therapeutic purposes has the potential to be used for the improvement of normal people, says Arthur L. Kaplan, professor of medical ethics at the University of Pennsylvania. This prospect raises some troublesome ethical issues. Many people are put off by the notion of physically bettering the brain, the root of thought, personality, individuality, and human nature itself. And some ethicists question the wisdom of handing new brain tools over to society so the privileged individuals can exploit them to get even further ahead of everyone else. Other scientists don't see the harm. If the cost of advanced brain technologies drops quickly and the surgical risks become less dire, people may request brain chips as casually as they receive a shot of Botox. And if that enhances their performance, then customers and clients are bound to share in the benefits. Don't we want our medical interns and pilots to have optimal brain function? Asked James J. Hughes, a professor of health policy at Trinity College in Hartford, Connecticut. Wouldn't that be an obligation of the job? It's a good question for our grandfathers to ponder with their medically enhanced minds. Interesting. You see, these things are something that is not something we're guessing about. It's something that we're really doing something about. What is it that we're suggesting here? We're suggesting that physically we can manipulate the cortex, the brain, and its various functioning to accomplish what we feel we'd like to have it accomplish. Now, I'll repeat that. Physically, we feel we can manipulate the neurons and protons and cortons of the brain to have them accomplish what we want them to accomplish. Now, in What the Bleep Do We Care? And in The Secret, we learned how the mind can be directed to beneficial things. And of course, we have learned that through our studies for years now. That if we so train our mind, we can have our mind be very, very outstanding and very, very gifted. When parents tell their children are geniuses, the children learn to believe this, act upon this, and express this. When parents tell their children they're idiots, they're stupid, they can't learn anything, they don't. They don't. In the 40s, there had been a great resurgence of mentality by schools. And the schools had a lot of children in them whose parents did not know how to read or write. They just had never taken high school or elementary school to learn how to read or write. They did not learn. And so, night schools and special schools were set up for the parents to learn to read and write. And then many pathetic stories came out in the press and in fiction writing about people who were learning to read and write and having magical things happen to them, which was quite nice. But it was at that time that the Depression people came along and they had to go to work and they didn't finish high school, they didn't finish elementary school, and they didn't finish their reading, writing, and arithmetic time, and they didn't learn the basics. Well, the thought of the school system at the time was if they didn't get it while they were in school, they'll never get it. They'll never be able to learn to read and write and do it. But a few courageous people stepped out and said, yes, we can. And these courageous people went to school with their children and sat in class with their children and studied reading, writing, and arithmetic and did it. And this made such a to-do that they began to establish schools for adult learning schools, adults learning basics in reading, writing, and arithmetic and so forth. And the Depression time had been very rough on many people because everybody had to work to bring in enough money to feed the family. Of course, they didn't realize that pulling up their zipper might have helped too. They'd have less children to feed, and every child then could have a little more to eat, you know. It had less children. But that is something the Chinese and the world just has never seemed to learn, that the zipper is a powerful tool for having smaller families. But aside from that, they did learn that the brain could learn even when you're out of school, even when you're an adult. And now we are learning that the brain can not only learn, but you can teach the brain to be open not only to outside learning but to inside learning. And this really is one of the major factors in the learning curve, that the learning comes from within, not so much from without but from within. So you learn how to learn, you learn how to be open to learning. If we can teach our children to learn how to learn, they've got their edge on all of life. They can accomplish anything. And if we can teach ourselves to do that, to learn how to learn, then we can do it. Now, we learn how to learn by believing that our brain has the capacity to learn. And what is it that I say learning is? Does anyone know the answer on that right away?
Learning is to understand that we already know.
No, yeah, yeah. Learning is to reveal that we already know it. You got part of it right. Learning is to reveal that we know it already. Learning is to reveal that within us all this knowledge already exists and we are but revealing it. And we think we have to pound it into our brain, that we have to learn and memorize soliloquies, and we have to learn and memorize. Although that learning and memorizing is not bad, but it's not the truth about learning. That is making our brain and our mind a little more facile. It is not necessarily making it more the ability to reveal what we have within us. And that's what we want to learn how to do. Yeah, learn. That's what we want to train ourselves to do, to train the brain to release, to reveal all of the knowledge that's already within us. Now, once we can start doing that, we will have magic truly in our bodies, in our life, in our affairs. Now, if parents today could teach that to their children, beautiful things would happen. Now, because of the Depression times, the concept went through people that you worked two jobs, not one, but two. I was going through high school during that time, and everybody worked two jobs. My father worked around the clock oftentimes, and I would work around the clock with him, and I would be in school during the day, and at night I'd be working with him in these manufacturing plants, putting in their brick ovens, doing the concrete work that my father did. And good money too, but the thing is, it slowed down my learning process a little bit because I was too tired, and I didn't realize that I was tired. Because, being a hip youngster, I worked hard And I worked hard, and I went to school hard, and then when I wasn't working, I came home, jumped in the shower, got all cleaned up, went out dancing. I mean, because, you know, that's what you're supposed to do. And I had 9 girlfriends, and I kept all of them busy, and we went dancing, square dancing, round dancing, foxtrot, you name the dancing, we did it, and I had a girl for each type of dance because they were good. And it was fun. And I even had girls for intelligence. One, Carol Kuhn, I told you about her. Her father was an aerospace scientist. And so I'd have dinner at her house one night a week. And we would learn about physics from him. And what an exciting adventure that was. What an exciting adventure. But you see, I was a very structured learning, revealing person, not knowing how much I was revealing, but I was just very blessed and very fortunate. And my parents didn't care one little bit what I did, because there were 5 of us kids, and they were busy doing all the things they were doing. So I went out and I did these things, and I had wonderful experiences. But what I'm pointing out is that we have this capacity. And because of the depression time, people thought they didn't have to sleep. And because they didn't have to sleep maybe 2, 3, 4 hours a night, you know, 5 hours at max, you know, and they didn't have to sleep, they thought they were doing the maximum a bit of production. They were using their time well and using their energies well. And to a degree it was right, because that's what we believed. But our bodies still craved for sleep, they still craved for that sort of thing. Now, today, technology is coming along just fine. And we have an article here. It's entitled, How to Sleep on the Job. And it has this little gadget here, quite a charming little gadget. Many of the major companies are buying them. I think they cost something like $12,485 for the energy pods. $12,485. Can you imagine? For a bed? Okay. New York-based Metro Naps is trying to sell companies on the merits of midday naps in an energy pod. The chair reclines to the ideal napping pose, posturing the legs at the same level as the heart. Nappers are soothed by meditation music and noise-canceling headphones. Oh, we have a pair of those, don't we? The soundproofed dome top provides privacy. Colleagues will never see you drool or hear you snore. Gentle lighting can be dimmed, and a programmable timer will wake the nappers with variations, vibrations, and light. Now, a couple of paragraphs here. Fatigue fighters. Business is waking up to the toll weariness takes on job performance and helping. Thank you. Employees get more shut-eye. What a very thoughtful thing to do. My agent should do that, you know. You. Shame. Thank you, Mr. Gregor. Business is waking up to the toll weariness can take on the job performance and helping employees to get more shut-eye. When Ashlyn Chowdhury was working as an investment analyst, he noticed a lot of his colleagues were sneaking into the bathrooms to take naps. So 4 years ago, he started Metro Naps, a New York company that sells resting chairs called Energy Pods for $12,485. These plush recliners lull users to sleep, then gently shake them awake after a specified time. Procter & Gamble has ordered a couple of the energy pods, as has Cisco Systems, which positions them as part of the company-wide effort to support employees' well-being, according to a spokesman. Some U.S. companies are waking up to the benefits of keeping workers alert. It started in industries such as aviation, trucking, and hospitals, where avoiding careless mistakes is a matter of life and death. Now, as news spreads about the toll fatigue takes on job performance, other industries are climbing aboard, teaching workers how to sleep better at night, shortening work shifts, and setting up napping rooms in corporate offices. While the trend may fly in the face of America's hyperactive work ethic, there's a growing body of evidence that naps help. At Bombardier Aerospace, a leading maker of small aircraft such as the Learjet, international research shows pilots who employed strategies to fight off drowsiness performed better than fatigued pilots on cockpit tasks such as responding to radio calls. Tired pilots sometimes fell into the micro-sleeps, zoning out for a few seconds, unaware, and thus reacting to events more slowly. Your brain shuts off and you can't control it, said Robert Augustino, director of flight operations for Bombardier's business aircraft unit. How does this translate to desk jobs? Just as a drowsy pilot is more likely to miss a radio call, a stock trader whose eyelids are drooping may have trouble pouncing on as many transactions as usual. People think they're fine. They are not, says Dr. Mark Rosekind, president of Alertness Solutions, a Cupertino, California consulting company that trains executives in simple techniques for improving alertness at work. Among Rosekind's tips, get more strategic about how you consume coffee. You'll get the maximum mental boost if you drink a cup 1/2 hour before an important meeting or other business events. Sitting in a brightly lit room just for 15 minutes helps too, as does exercise. And a nap, of course. You won't necessarily lose if you snooze. So, quite an interesting concept. We have sort of poo-pooed it and denied it and not given ourselves the proper attention to it. And because we have done that, we have thrown away a lot of beautiful benefits that we could have from it. Now, I have set up a policy here that after each lunch, we take 15-20 minutes to half an hour for a nap. And I have felt that this is a very vital and dynamic thing to do. And Ellen countermanded me, and she says, no, after lunch, we'll take an hour and a half break for a nap and whatever else we want to do. And I said, you're the boss. I feel that if we follow what they suggest here, now there are other articles. Winston Churchill was famous for taking a 20-minute to half-hour nap every once in a while during the day, and he was always a pile of energy. Edison, Edison, the creator of the light bulb, he did the same thing, and many others do it too. Scientific studies have been shown that if you take a nap longer than 15 to 20 minutes, then you're not getting any benefit. In fact, you're getting a deficit because you are now going into another level of sleep, which is making your body feel that it wants to sleep. And we have children who sometimes come up here and their parents want to get rid of them, and so they put them to sleep. They lay them down and they say, go back to sleep, go back to sleep. And then at night the kids can't sleep because they're all slept out during the day. The nap should be a rejoiner. It should be something that sort of picks you up. It's not necessarily taking care of your night nap, your night's sleep. It is something that energizes you for a very happy, healthy, hearty day. And when a man and wife lay down for 15, 20 minutes, it shouldn't be a sex break, it should be a nap break. It would be much more effective and much more powerful. Then have your sex break. But the thing is, if you don't get that nap in at the right time, you don't get the full benefit out of it for your day. This is true throughout industry, throughout normal business, throughout the homes. Mother, oftentimes after she sends the kids off to school at noon if they come home for lunch, or after she has had her lunch, she'll go take a nap. And then 1:30, she's up and at it again, just full of vim and vinegar, him. And that's great. I think it's very important for us not to poo-poo these things that come to our attention, because when we do that, we belittle ourselves. Now, we're talking here about tune into the divine path within through introspection in the three-hour meditation. Now, you heard the three-hour meditation this morning. I listened to part of it because it didn't want to shut off on my Apple computer. It just kept playing. And I have to figure it out. Heinz had to show me how to turn that on and off and make it go. But on this here, I know exactly how to do everything. And perhaps that's what I should do more of. Tune in to the divine path within through introspection in the three-hour meditation. What do we do during introspection? Anybody?
Listen to the divine within.
We listen to the divine within. I'm not going to ask any of you to answer my question here. You don't speak up loud enough so that this can pick it up. Okay, we listen to the divine within. Now, what do we hear the divine within say? Anybody?
Whatever we have programmed in our consciousness.
That sounds a little ostentatious, but whatever we have been thinking about, whatever we have been thinking about, programmed into our consciousness, that's rather a grand way to say it, it's the same thing. But whatever we've been thinking about, that's what our introspection time does with us. And God acts just like us. And so if we say, I can't, I can't, I can't, then our introspective time is going to show us ways that we can't. If we say we can, our introspective time is going to show us that we can. It's going to just open up the doorways of our thinking, because we're going to think about positive things. Now, you know the story about the little train. I think I can, I think I can, I think I can, I think I can. And he works his way up over the mountaintop. And when he gets over the top, he says, I know I can, I know I can. Now, whoosh, down he goes. I know I can. Now, this is how we are. On our way up, if we say, I don't know how, I don't know how, I don't know how, we'll never get to the top. We'll park halfway up the hill and walk if we have to go up. But we'll never get to the top. We want to keep ourselves as positive and powerful and beneficial to ourselves as we can do it. Now, we've seen this here. We've seen this. Now, I think the author thought he was cute in saying nobody will see you drooling or see you
snoring.
And that's totally uncalled for. Totally uncalled. Now, if he would say you would sleep in privacy and you could have a good 15, 20 minutes sleep, totally unaware of anything else going on around you for that moment. You see, who is it for? It's for the individual. It is not for the people who are peeking. It's not for the people who are watching. It's not for the pornographic nuts, you know? For the idiots who get their thrill by seeing other people do exciting things, you know, stupid. And when people, you can always tell. You can always tell when people write like this and they have the little chinks in their armor, and it messes up the whole story. Because what do you remember? You remember the guy drooling and snoring, you know. That's not what he's doing. He has music going on in his head. She, he, they. And they're probably in bliss. My goodness sakes. When are you drooling and snoring? When you are in an uncomfortable sleep. When you are in an uncomfortable meditation. When you are distressed in your being. Should that chair make you distressed? No, it should make you very, very relaxed and very peaceful. You see, I tell everyone here as we watch movies in the evening, what is the redeeming quality of the movie? Now, every movie has some redeeming qualities, some less than others and some more than others. But now, what was the redeeming quality of this chair. The redeeming quality of the chair is that it allows you, in privacy, to lie and sleep for 10 to 20 minutes, undisturbed about the world about you. You put on your headphones and you are out of the world. You are in bliss. Nobody's peeking at you, because that is a chair where you go to do that. Now, on the airplane in first class, in the cocoons that they have on the airplane, do you think that the people lying in those cocoons are thinking that the stewardesses are coming around peeking at them, seeing if they're having a horny dream, or seeing if they're drooling, or seeing if there's, you know, no way. No way. The stewardesses are doing everything they can to make that a sacred moment, to make that the most treasured experiences. So one day every plane will have cocoons for everybody. Ha, ha, ha. How about that? And wouldn't that be a delightful experience? Now, why not? Why not? And these are things that are fantastic. This type of thing is lovely. I personally look forward to the day that we have a cocoon like in that story, Cocoon. Remember the movie Cocoon? And they put those cocoons into the swimming pool, and they dove in that swimming pool, and they were cocooned. They were literally made young again. And but that's not a joke. Not that you have to dive into a special water that re-energizes you, but it's here. It's in the mind. Now, do you know why they also thought it was in the mind? Because in the movie Cocoon, everybody dove into that pool and everybody was energized. Each person used it according to their own interest. So the one lady used it as a teacher. One man loved to dance and show off. And all, each for their own interest. And so for us to compare the interests, the way in which each is sharing how they use it, is foolish. We don't want to do that. We want to be aware that this is a universal concept of mentally alerting our stem cells to realize it, take over, you know, I'm young again. And you may be 20 years old, you may be 30, 40, but you're young again. You're 18, you're whatever young means to you. And young doesn't necessarily mean years. Young means vital, dynamic, alive. Vital, dynamic, alive. You're vital, dynamic, and alive. And that's what we want to realize. This is what we work with when we tune into the divine path within through introspection, through our three-hour meditation, where we're vital, dynamic, alive, and we live it. We recognize that the divine indwelling is our playful self, and we should take life lightly. I gave you the illustration during our three-hour meditation, and I gave it to you how during the introspective time I was talking with God, and I was saying to God, now just wait a minute, aren't you being kind of obstreperous? Aren't you being kind of thoughtless? Aren't you? And God says, I'm just being you. You know, I'm just being who you are. When you get your act together, then I'll have my act together. I cannot have my act together until you have your act together, because I have no place to go. If you're acting like a fool, I have to act like a fool with you. And then you think I'm a fool. But if you're acting like a genius, you got the point, acting like it, then the brain, the white stem cells, the beautiful stem cells say, they will act like a genius. Role model. We give the role model to our stem cells, we give the role model to our inner self, and then we'll act like it. Techniques. We talk, we think, we walk. Be at the center of our being. We talk, think, walk, and be with the center of our being. Now, how do we talk with the center of our being? What do we say to talk to the center of our being? Well, first, what is the center of our being? Is the center of our being our divine nature? Or is the center of our being our godly self, or our divine self, or is it the center of our being, the white, beautiful stem cells themselves? Undifferentiated, they are original purity and integrity. That's nice, huh? That's nice. Would you like to be your original purity and integrity? Your original divine stem cells? Wow, hey, that's cool. Well, perhaps that's what it is. The center of our being is our original purity and integrity. Okay. Now, how do we talk our original purity and integrity? We talk our original purity and integrity by always saying, I like me, I'm divine order and peace. I like me, I'm divine order and peace. I am whole and perfect. I live in my ideal spirit, mind, and body. And when you go out on the path here, this morning, I mean, except for Ingeborg, all of you are diaper children, you know, as far as I'm concerned. But how many of you walked the full path around the property this morning? None of you. Not even Ellen. Ellen pretends to. And you don't do it. Now, here I am giving these seminars, giving these lectures, being up at 2 in the morning, being ready for you at 3, and being here giving these seminar lectures, and then afterwards, and putting them on the internet right away. I mean, well, that's pretty good. Pretty good, you know? I mean, I'd hire me if I were you. But and then, after I'm done doing that, I go over and I set up my computer at the house and I check out the emails and I check out the things that have to be done. Then I walk the 3-mile path around the property twice. I walk once, and then when I get to the house, then I come back. And Rex usually likes to go once. And so when I get to the house, he just likes to wander over and see what's going on over there. Because he runs the path maybe 3 or 4 times to my once. But I go the 6 miles. And then I come back, and I get ready for breakfast with you guys, and have a nice breakfast, and talk more with you guys. Then come and give these things. Now, I'm not trying to say I'm good. I'm trying to tell you, it's up here. It's not down here. Your body, yes, but your body will respond to what's in your mind. Now, what do you want your body to do? Do you want your body to say it's tired? Well, I didn't have much sleep last night. Who did, huh? We went to bed at 8 or 9 o'clock, and we got up at 2, at least I did. When did you get up? You know, got up at 3 maybe, or 10 minutes to 3, and dashed over here, and then acted tired? Because you said, I'm tired, you know? You put these causes in motion. And Ellen, as I have told you again and again and again, don't do that. Because if I say, you act tired, and you act tired, and you're shaking your head. No, my goodness sakes, you know what you're doing? You're saying, I really was tired, and I got to protest that I wasn't tired, and I got to pretend that I wasn't, and say that I wasn't, even though I was. But, you see, you're telling us right away, you're drooling, you know? And you don't want to do that. Don't, Ellen, do you know what a fighter does? He watches his opponent for a telegraphed punch. And when he sees a telegraphed punch, he avoids it. You know what a telegraphed punch is? It's a punch that's coming, and the other fighter knows it, and so he ducks aside from it. Now, you're telegraphing your attitudes to us by shaking your head yes or shaking your head no. I must say, speaking to an audience with mobile heads, it's kind of fun sometimes, because you look at the bunch of idiots and you think to yourself, boy, do you realize you're not fooling anybody? But they think they are. So be careful and never protest. If I say, Ellen, you did this terrible thing, and you say, oh, tell me more, you know. And then I go on and I go on. That's interesting. And you're untouched by it. Now, you shouldn't do terrible things, okay? But you should be untouched anytime anybody wants to shake your boat. You be the master. You be on top of it. Now, that's playing the game. See, that's thinking, talking, walking, and being what you are. Can you be a good role model for your stem cells? Heinz, are you... Now, don't answer me, because you're going to stick your foot in your mouth. Heinz, are you a good role model for your white how do I say white all the time? Maybe that's because they're pure, original purity and integrity. Are you a good role model for your stem cells, born new every day, which are your original purity and your original integrity? Are you a good role model for them to say that they have just moved in to the most sacred, wonderful body in the universe, the most sacred, wonderful mind in the universe, to the most sacred, wonderful consciousness that ever existed, and on and on and on? Can you even visualize that your stem cells would believe that moving into your house? Is that the kind of reception they would get? Are all of your corners swept clean of dust? Are all of your tablecloths in proper order? Are all of your spoons put on your table in the right order, and your knives and forks? Is your house an inviting house to these beautiful white stem cells who are undifferentiated, who have never been told what to do? They're just waiting. Oh, Master, tell me what you will have me do. What do you want from me, Master? Yeah, meat, 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 meat. Okay, now, is that what they find in you, Heinz? And Heinz would like to say yes, 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 but he's saying it in his heart, and that's where it should be said. Now, what about you, Gregor? Is that what they find in you? Ellen, do they find that in you? Sylvia, do they find that in you? Is there any dust in you any place? Do they find that in you? Don't grit your teeth. Smile. You're on candid camera. You're on Herbie's camera. Ingeborg, do they find that in you? Don't answer. Rebecca, Sunnybrook Farm. Rochelle, do they find that in you? Do they find that purity, that original purity and integrity that you are, and they can match their own original purity and integrity with that? Do they find in you the ideal mother, the ideal wife, the ideal employee, the ideal human being, the ideal divine being? Oh, ho, ho, ho. You know, do they find that in you? And if your answer is yes, or at least you're working on it, that's good. But this is what your stem cells must find in you for maximum performance on their behalf. Recognize that the divine indwelling is our playful self, and take life lightly. And techniques to do that: talk, think, walk, be with the center of your being. Be with the center of your being. Be that. Isn't that nice? Isn't that kind of fun? Now, are you ready for something like that? Are you ready to really be that? Now, our last point here. Let go of the mystery of inner presence. Be one as its awareness. Let go of the mystery of inner presence. Be one as its awareness. How can we let go the mystery of our inner presence? We let go of it by having a key. And I'm going to give you each a key. It's a mantra key. And each mantra is different, you know. That's what they tell us. So you each get a different key. Now, I want all of you to close your minds, your hearts, your being, while I tell Heinz. And then when I tell Gregor. And then when I tell Ellen. And when I tell Sylvia. When I tell Irene and Ingeborg and Rochelle. Now, each one of them, don't listen. Don't listen. Now, this is the secret. The secret is, I like me, I'm divine order, I'm peace. That is the secret key that will unlock your awareness of the divinity within you. How do we defer this here? Let go of the mystery of inner presence. Be one as its awareness. That's your key to the inner presence. I like me, I'm divine order, I'm peace. That's your key to the inner presence. I like me, I'm divine order. You've heard that before, Heinz?
Yes.
Once or twice? Mm-hmm. I like me, I'm divine order, I'm peace. This is the key that opens your inner presence. This is the key that gives you the freedom to come and go as you wish. You have a question?
Yeah.
Answer it.
Let go.
Huh?
You say you let go.
Let go of the mystery of the inner presence. Let go of the secrecy of the inner presence. Let go of that you cannot get to it. It's mysterious.
Reveal it.
Huh?
Reveal it.
Reveal it. You see, you're going to a mystery show. It's something you don't know. You don't know who done it, you know? And that's what the mystery is. Let go of this mystery of the inner presence. Let go of this who done it. You don't know who done it. And know that you are the one who has the key. You are the one who says, I like me, I'm divine order, I'm peace. And then be one as its awareness. Be one as its awareness. That's good that you picked out that word and took umbrage with it. And I think you should do that. So think those thoughts. They're very good. Do you like that? Do I give them a few interesting words now and then? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Sort of tickle their funny bone. I love words. Okay. We will now have a moment of rest, relaxation, and then we'll rush back here for our daily workshop, number one. And our workshop is entitled Play and Relax. So it is now 3:05. So at 3:05, come back to me. I love you.
I love you.
I love you.